So we're looking this morning at Luke chapter 6, and we're mostly looking from verses 12 through to 26, and I've given it the title Pressing On, Following Jesus, A Path of Blessing and Suffering. So those are some of the sort of themes that we're going to be picking up this morning. There's these four little scenes that are described for us in these verses. Some of them are very short. The first one is that Jesus prays, only a verse about that. And then Jesus chooses his disciples, a couple of verses there. Then Jesus heals, again, quite a short little bit, just two or three verses. And then a slightly longer chunk of Jesus' teaching, and that carries on. Then we're just going to look at the first little bit of it. And yet through these things, I try and sort of point out how we can notice these themes that keep coming up, this sort of combination of there being suffering and blessing as we follow Jesus. And hopefully we're going to see a little bit of that in each of those four scenes, but probably most of all in that teaching bit at the end. So those are the themes we'll sort of be looking along, of what it means to follow Jesus, to press on close to him, and involving those two themes of suffering and blessing in following Jesus. Well, if we look first of all then at Jesus praying, we have this lovely verse given for us in verse 12, that in those days there might be a little bit of a gap between these things, but in those days he went out on the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. Luke, more than any of the other gospel writers, mentioned Jesus praying more often than anyone else. And sometimes, no doubt, those were specific times as well as just regular times that Jesus prayed. But here seems to be one of particular intensity when Jesus goes out, tries to get away from everyone else for a moment so he can spend time with God. He goes up on a mountain, not to enjoy the view or a strenuous climb. He goes there to be with God. And he goes up there on the mountain and he prays all night long. Prays all night. And so there's something quite intense going on with that. And again, we might sort of try and understand why. Why at this moment does Luke mention it and Jesus do it, spend this time in prayer? And I think you could probably look both ways, if you know what I mean, in these verses. Look back at the previous verses. One of the reasons Jesus came to pray might have been because of this conflict. Elijah read it in the bit that happened before, and we did more of that in the weeks we've been through. That over the end of chapter 5 and then into chapter 6, there's this growing conflict with the Pharisees and the scribes, and trouble is brewing. And we're told in that last verse of that section, verse 11, they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. And we know what they're going to do. So they're beginning to think through that kind of thing. So that's bubbling away in the background. All this conflict. And that's something quite thought-provoking, isn't it? How does Jesus respond to that? He turns away to pray. He doesn't confront them. He doesn't go to loggerheads with them. No, he draws away. He goes to pray. He goes to commit these things to his Father in prayer. And what's going to happen in the next few verses, again, might give us a hint of why Jesus has such an intense night of prayer. Well, in verses 13 onwards, he's going to choose the disciples. And so Jesus might have both of those things in mind. Might be on the one hand looking back at these conflicts he's just had with the Pharisees and so on. And knowing, of course, that's going to get worse. They plan to do away with him, we're told in verse 11. And in the end, they will. And Jesus commits that to the Lord. Perhaps even the role that the Pharisees and others would have in that. He comes and comes to pray to his Father in heaven. And after he's gone, after the cross and his resurrection and his ascension into glory, who's going to carry on this task? Well, it's going to be these disciples. And so Jesus wants to commit that too and to pray about that as he chooses those. And Jesus presses on with his task. He was human. And so no one likes to be faced with hatred and conflict like this. And yet Jesus knew that path he was treading, that path of obedience to his Father, to the cross. And it was a path for himself that was going to involve blessing for him and then to be glorified afterwards. So it would bring suffering for him. Did I say that wrong? Suffering for him and yet blessing for his people. And so as we think of that example of the Lord Jesus and then think of ourselves and apply it to ourselves in following Jesus, we have those same things on the path, don't we? Times of blessing and suffering. And here we're given a secret, aren't we, of Jesus' strength and his ability to continue through those things. It came from prayer. And so for us as well, whether we're facing times of great blessing and happiness and so on, or whether we're going through times of suffering and sorrow, we do need to keep up those regular times of prayer. And maybe sometimes special situations call for special prayer as well. So we have that little bit, an example there of Jesus and his prayer life. And then on in the next verses, Jesus comes down from this mountain. It's now daytime, verse 13, and he chooses these disciples. It seems there are many followers of Jesus. And we've noticed before, the people mentioned in these verses, they've been mentioned before too. Jesus borrowed Simon's boat, didn't he, to preach from before. John's gospel seems to give us a little bit of the earlier life of some of the disciples. Again, Simon and Andrew and James and John and Philip and some of their involvement earlier on in the life of Jesus. And now, no doubt, there were crowds of people, we're going to meet them later on, verse 17, who are around Jesus. But Jesus chooses 12 to be specifically his disciples, perhaps with a capital D in that sort of sense. And as we've looked at with the children, they're the learners. They were his disciples. And it was a common thing in the sense most teachers or rabbis, as they were called in the land of Israel, would have had followers who listened to their teaching. So that was partly it. Jesus was the rabbi. They were the disciples who were going to be listening and learning from Jesus, who were going to follow him around and learn from all that he had to share with them. But there's an eye to the future as well. They're going to be the apostles. He names them, verse 13, last little words of that. He named them apostles. They were going to be sent out by him. They were going to be sent out as eyewitnesses, as proclaimers of the gospel. When Jesus' ministry here on earth would come to an end, they were going to then carry on the task, sharing everything they'd seen with their own eyes. And so these disciples are called together and they're going to be there with Jesus virtually every minute of every day from then on, because they're going to be the eyewitnesses who are going to have to give an account. They are going to be called into court about the things they saw and heard from Jesus. They're going to go out into all the world proclaiming it to others. And so Jesus chooses 12. There's probably there a little bit of an echo from the Old Testament, where there were the 12 sons of Jacob, and who became then the 12 tribes of Israel. And Jesus here chooses 12. And perhaps again with an eye to where this was going. They were going to be his witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. And God was going to be drawing people from every nation. And under the sort of the headship, under the foundation of these 12 apostles. And so John, one of the disciples, in some of the last verses of the Bible, pictures the city, the heavenly Jerusalem. And he pictures an innumerable multitude of people coming from all the nations of the world. And they're coming into a city that has as its foundations 12 apostles that written on it, in this sort of pictorial sense, in the book of Revelation. But it's all there starting this thing that Jesus is doing here. And Jesus calls them to follow him. And that wasn't going to be easy for them. And so we'll get in a moment to verse 20, where Jesus teaches his disciples, we're told, verse 20. And he's going to teach them, because they're going to be the ones Verse 22, who are hated and excluded and reviled and cast out because their names are evil for the Son of Man's sake. Those things were going to happen to the 12 in the first instance. And so Jesus has a lot to teach them, because it isn't going to be easy. Following Jesus is going to involve blessing, yes, but suffering too. And Jesus needs to prepare them for that. So there we have these 12 disciples who are in the first instance drawn to Jesus and then sent by him. And actually in that pattern, just in that way that Jesus acted in his life, in his relationship with the disciples, in some ways that again pictures a little bit of what our lives are like as Christians. We draw together, especially on a Sunday, don't we? We draw together on the Lord's Day to come and to listen to Jesus. And we come together and we turn away from the other things in the world and the other things that might keep us busy. And we come to listen and learn from Jesus as his disciples. We've come this morning, we can meet again this evening and so on. And then at the end of the service, we're kind of sent away again. We're sent out to be apostles in a sense, not with the kind of authoritative position that they had, but we are still sent out by Jesus on a Monday morning into school and into our workplaces, into our homes, into our neighbourhoods. We're sent out then with that. And so that pattern of coming in together and then going out is there found in the Gospels too, isn't it? Just like we do in our life as a church. One other thing as Jesus chooses his disciples is something quite bizarre. I mean, we know the story, but the way Luke tells it to us in verse 16, he tells us Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor. And that's how Luke describes it. I should say Jesus chooses Judas, who would become a traitor. And what a strange thing that is. We might otherwise have thought at this moment that Jesus has made a mistake. Jesus spent the whole night in prayer asking help from his Father in choosing 12 disciples, and he still picks a dud. How did it go wrong? But Jesus did it deliberately. It is no mistake. Jesus knew what would happen. And there's an interesting aside for us. Often we pray so that things would go smoothly, don't we? You might pray at the beginning of the day that, you know, God would bless the different things that you and your family are doing that day. And we pray because we want things to go smoothly. We don't want the car to break down. We don't want to miss the bus. We don't want there to be a trouble at work or whatever it is. And then sometimes when something does go wrong, we think, oh, it's because I didn't pray. But that's to muddle the whole thing up. Here, something goes wrong. Jesus picks Judas, who's going to become a traitor. But it isn't because he didn't pray. He did pray. And yet prayer doesn't eliminate suffering. Sometimes we think, oh, if only I've got to just pray more about this and then God will take the bumps out the road and make it nice and smooth from now on. But that isn't what he promises at all. So here Jesus prays and then he goes and consciously chooses Judas to be his disciple, knowing what would happen. Knowing the conflict that's happened already with the Pharisees, Jesus chooses Judas to be his disciple, knowing the role he would play in being a traitor and betraying Jesus to the Pharisees, who are just mentioned in the previous paragraph. Jesus prays and then presses on with this path that has been ordained for him by the Father, and so he chooses this disciple who would cause him nothing but trouble and heartache, and who would betray him. He chooses Judas because what Judas would do by his own free choices would be part of the path to the cross. And Jesus has committed that all to the Lord in prayer that night before, and chooses the disciple who will get things towards the cross, get things heading in that direction, who would play such a role. There's also another side to it as well. Jesus chooses a traitor, an informant, a spy, that's a really odd move, isn't it? Except if you've got nothing to hide. Normally, you'd have thought Jesus would pick together people who would be drawn to him, people who would be on his side. But here Jesus chooses Judas, who's on the enemy's side, who's a spy, who's there under false pretenses, who's there with his own motives. He's there working for the enemy. And then, of course, later on, when Judas goes to the chief priests and the Pharisees, they could just turn around to him and go, well, you've seen everything there is to see about Jesus. Tell us the secrets. We've heard what Jesus says in public. Judas, you tell us what Jesus talks about when it's just him, when it's just you guys. Oh yeah, Jesus can put on this good show in public, but you, Judas, know the real story. But Judas has got nothing. He's got no dirt on Jesus, despite being with him as an informant for 3 years. If anyone would have the gossip, as it were, if anyone would have the bad stuff that Jesus had been up to, it would be Judas, wouldn't it? And so there again is something in the wisdom of Jesus in picking an eyewitness who was working for the other side. But again, it just adds, doesn't it, to that transparent clarity of Jesus, doesn't it? Most people are so afraid. You know, our politicians and big companies are all afraid of whistleblowers and things like that, aren't they? Someone who manages to escape from the company and tell the truth about what's happening behind closed doors. But Jesus has nothing to hide. He chooses Judas and says, come and learn from me. Come and watch everything I do, knowing full well what he'd do in the end. He's got nothing, nothing to hide. And Jesus embarks on that path of suffering, knowing the blessing that we bring to his people. On to the third section then, in verses 17 to 19. Luke just gives us another summary. He gives quite a few of these as he goes along, of Jesus' healing. And we're told there's a great multitude of people who gather with his disciples, verse 17. And they come from a wide variety of places too. They come from Judea and Jerusalem too. So some of them made a pretty long trek. They come from the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon to come to Jesus. And again, there's a little bit of a picture. Jesus has picked the 12 disciples, and then in the next few verses you read of people all coming together. A little bit. Tyre and Sidon were right on the very borders of Israel. A lot of Gentiles lived there. They weren't really proper Israel territory anymore under the Romans. And so when people come from there, there might again be a hint, actually, this is much bigger than you think. There's people coming from Jerusalem, Judea, people coming from the coastlands and things like that, all turning to Jesus. And they come and he heals them all. They come with all their diseases, those who are tormented with evil spirits too. And we're just told very simply, end of verse 18, and they were healed. And the whole multitude sought to touch him, for power went out from him and healed them all. There they all gather to Jesus. And perhaps because of their suffering, because of their diseases, because of these evil spirits and things, their suffering drove them to Jesus, drove them to Christ. They're all clamoring round him. They're all just wanting to touch him, just in reaching out their hand and touching, as Luke gives us another example later on, just his cloak, and they're healed. And Jesus sends out his power to heal each one of them. He generously gives to every single one of them. None of them are turned away. There is just overflowing grace and power coming from Jesus. And they received this blessing. Their diseases were healed. The evil spirits were driven out. Their lives were transformed by coming near to Jesus. Again, what an encouragement there is to us. Perhaps sometimes in our suffering that drives us to Jesus, the one who's overflowing with grace and power. But it is interesting, in verse 20, Jesus then carries on. He lifted up his eyes towards the disciples and said, blessed blessed are you. Look at that in just a moment. They had received blessing from Jesus, but was there more to being blessed that they didn't know quite yet? These crowds that came looking for healing, and you can understand it, that those who were suffering with diseases or one sort or another, they wanted to be well. But did they know that Jesus could do more than that? Did they know that Jesus hadn't just come to heal them? But there was a deeper blessing carrying on in verse 20. So Jesus takes the opportunity then to teach. Because there was a risk, perhaps, some of them just wanted a quick fix. Just wanted to be relieved from the symptoms of their suffering that they were enduring. And didn't want anything more than that. But Jesus has got more to give. More than just a quick fix. More than just for Jesus to take the suffering away and to take the illness away. Jesus then turns to his disciples, but there's a whole crowd around as they listen at this point. And so lastly, the sort of the longer section, Jesus teaches. It's similar in its content to the Sermon on the Mount. It carries on from here and follows on to the end of the chapter. It starts with these statements of blessing, and it finishes with a well-known parable about building on the rock, the same as Matthew's account of the Sermon on the Mount. But strangely, here in verse 17, we're told that Jesus stood on a level place, not a mount. And it has some similarities, but then some things that are quite different. Luke's version is quite shorter. It has some bits, extra bits, though, that Matthew doesn't have. And Matthew has some things that Luke doesn't have. So my hunch is that actually they're two separate sermons. It was just that Jesus was in the habit of repeating himself sometimes and saying similar things, but maybe slightly altered to speak to the people who were around at the time. So here we have this message of Jesus. And a shorter version of these statements of blessing, the Beatitudes in Matthew, are probably more well known than this. But if we just look at these statements for a moment. Verse 20, blessed are you poor. Verse 21, blessed are you who hunger now. And then blessed are you who weep now. Luke has these things, just these quite simple statements. And we might wonder a little bit more about what was Jesus meaning by those things. Jesus did show blessing, give blessing and show compassion to those who were poor. And he did feed those who were hungry. And he did comfort those who were weak, weeping like Mary and Martha. Jesus did give blessing to people who came into those three categories. And Jesus' followers should do too. We are commanded too to show kindness to the poor, to the hungry, to those who weep. But is there more going on than that? If you look at the fourth and the longest one of these little statements, verse 22, blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and revile you and cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. The fourth and longest of the statements seems to add a little bit more, doesn't it? That makes you think perhaps you're meant to read the whole four through in one go and get to the end and see what he's driving at. That last little statement, for the Son of Man's sake. I think what Jesus is talking about as he turns to his disciples, verse 20, he's turning to those who are following him and says, blessed are you. Blessed are you, the 12 he'd just chosen, maybe others who are following him as well. Blessed are you, poor. Blessed are you who hunger now. Blessed are you who weep now. Blessed are you when men hate you, exclude you, revile you, and cast you out as evil for the Son of Man's sake. And that would happen to the disciples. For the Son of Man's sake, they would be thrown out of the synagogues. For the Son of Man's sake, what they were doing, the good they were doing, would be called evil. They would be those who were poor. They would be those who would weep and be hungry. Following the Son of Man, living for the Son of Man's sake, may mean a path of suffering. And Jesus seems to be teaching the crowd and teaching his disciples that following Jesus is not going to be easy. It's going to be a path of suffering. And we've thought already that's the case for Jesus. He willingly chose that path of suffering, heading to the cross, tooting Judas, and all that we've covered already. And here Jesus brings in, end of verse 23, for the same they did to the prophets. We're part of a wider group here. Sometimes when things are tough and there is that suffering, we think, oh, why me? Like it's only me who's having this trouble. But it's not. Jesus is trying to say, no, they did that to the prophets. You're in a big group here of God's people. It was a path that Jesus himself would tread. It was the path that Old Testament people of God had to tread too. And so for us, following Jesus may involve suffering. But there's also the whole statement he makes. Blessed are you. Blessed are you. Four times he says it to his disciples. Blessed are you. Even if there is poverty and weeping and hunger and ridicule and persecution, blessed are you. You're on a path of blessing as well as a path of suffering. It's both. A path of blessing now. Blessed are you. Four times he tells them. When these things happen, verse 23, rejoice in that day and leap for joy. Rejoice now. You are blessed now. And great is your reward in heaven. There'll be blessing to come as well. And so you will receive those things. The poor, yes, you're poor now, but you'll receive the kingdom of God. You're hungry now, but you will be filled. You weep now, but you shall laugh. All of these things are happening. There is a path of suffering, but it is a path of blessing too. To follow Jesus, to walk with him, to be blessed by him, and to receive a reward to come in heaven. As Jesus teaches, he does sort of cover the other side, the flip side of the coin, a warning too. Perhaps there would be some in that crowd who'd just come for that quick fix, who didn't really want to follow Jesus, who just wanted to be healed and things like that. And maybe there's a warning too from that. Verse 24, woe to you who are rich. Verse 25, woe to you who are full. Woe to you who laugh now. Woe to you when all men speak well of you. Those are quite strong things that Jesus says, and they're so upside down from the way we see things in the world, aren't we? We look at someone who's rich and say, oh, they're blessed. We look at someone who's full, who's happy, who laughs. We say, they're blessed. But we're misusing the word. We think of someone when everyone speaks well of them. And sometimes we might look for those things and seek those things. It might look like what the world calls blessed. But Jesus says, no. Think about the false prophets. Again, an Old Testament link. The Old Testament had loads of false prophets who came preaching made-up messages. Nothing from God at all. And they got rich. And they had plenty of food. And they laughed and were happy. And everyone told them they were doing a jolly good job. But Jesus says, no. That wasn't blessed. People might have guessed it. But you got it completely upside down. No. Woe to them. Jesus shouts a warning. And what a reminder for us. It's so easy to go out into the world seeking riches and a full belly and laughter and happiness and for everyone to be nice to us. Sometimes those are exactly the things we seek, aren't they? But Jesus says, no. Those things are just the pleasures of this world, and you can get all of that and then have judgment afterwards. And so we're called to follow Jesus. Here Jesus gives this warning not to follow the world, not to be after all the things which given to us in the adverts we see every day, but to come instead to Jesus. Jesus called his disciples to himself. Here he teaches his disciples, wanting them to draw closer to him. Maybe sometimes we come to Jesus driven by our suffering. Maybe sometimes we can come when we're not, and when we've got everything we need. But Jesus here warns us, we can receive all of those things and still fall into judgment. It's not the things of this world. What would it benefit a man to gain the whole world and then lose his soul? Jesus warned elsewhere. And so we come to Jesus not just for a quick fix, but we come to him genuinely, in repentance and faith, coming to Jesus, the one who chose the path of suffering, of betrayal and death for us, so that we might receive blessing from him. For there at the cross, all that suffering that came upon him brings peace upon us. Everything that he was weighed down with, the sin and guilt, well, we receive forgiveness and new life. We receive blessing from him. And then we're called to follow. To follow on after him, close as we can to him. A path of blessing and suffering. Not trying to avoid one, but realizing the two can come together. That as we follow Jesus, we are blessed. Blessed now, even if there are struggles, even if there are still bumps in the road. And a great reward that he's given for us in heaven. Let's come and sing our last hymn to finish. I will sing the wondrous story of the Christ who died for me. One that reminds us a little bit of that path that Jesus trod, so that he might bless us, all that he's given for us.